You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 25th Saturday reading of the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Aurora Council won't step in to prevent more than $2.5 million in looming cuts to programs for cities homeless. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. APS leans toward turning Parish School into a community center, but lease price is an issue. By Christine O., Sentinel, Colorado. Suspect identified in murder of Centennial Man. By Taylor Shaw. LPS swears in new members, says goodbye to Reichardt. By Nina Joss. Littleton City Council swears in elected members. By Nina Joss. Littleton approves $144 million budget for 2024. By Nina Joss. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Aurora. Aurora lawmakers on Monday rejected the suggestion that the city compensate for failing marijuana tax revenues by investing other funds in local homelessness service agencies, meaning food and shelter programs will likely be scaled back in 2024. Conservative council members argued that agencies should ask their donors for more money rather than rely on the city and fluctuating marijuana tax dollars for funding. This is not guaranteed money. This is not just a guaranteed handout, council member Danielle Jurinski said. I know how budgets work. Go fundraise. Aurora taxes retail marijuana sales to fund services for the city's homeless residents as well as youth violence prevention programs. Pot sales have declined as the COVID-19 pandemic has waned. In September, the city reported that marijuana sales tax revenues fell by 11% in 2022 and that revenues were down by about 8.5% in 2023 compared to the previous year. In total, the amount of marijuana funds available to homelessness services agencies dropped from $3.9 million from 2023 to $1.4 million to 2024. COVID-19 relief funds are also drying up, as pandemic-specific grants and the city's remaining American Rescue Plan Act money is spent down. Monday's agenda item included a list of staff recommendations for about $2 million in grants to be awarded to 8 agencies. Service providers have said the multi-million dollar cut will jeopardize programs such as Mile High Behavioral Health Care's Cold Weather Shelter and Meal Services and the pallet shelters operated by the Salvation Army. On Monday, council member Allison Combs suggested that the council use other city funds to continue funding organizations at 2023 levels. All of these agencies are continuing to provide or intend to continue to provide the same level of service, if not more, Combs said. If we're not continuing to spend the money we spend on encampment sweeps and other programs, but we don't have anywhere for people to go, that's going to make the problems worse of community members contacting us and asking why the sweeps aren't working. Deputy City Mayor Manager Roberto Venegas said that there was $300,000 in unspent ARPA funds that could be used to make up part of the $2.5 million shortfall in marijuana tax revenues. But conservatives on the city council rejected the idea, with council member Curtis Gardner saying the city and Aurora households have had to make cuts to account for economic conditions, suggesting agencies should also learn to work with smaller contributions from the city. He proposed that this council sign off on the grant recommendations but not try to find other funds to make up for the shortfall. To think that money coming from the government in the form of a grant is ongoing and promised forever is really inappropriate, Gardner said. We have need after need in this city. We have a capital projects list that is nearly $1 billion long. Council member Francois Bergen initially suggested that the council put off voting on the grant recommendations until January, but ultimately agreed with Gardner's proposal along with a majority of the council. Progressives Ruben Medina and Combs both objected to the proposal moving forward from Monday's study session, with Combs saying she objected in the strongest terms to leave our most vulnerable residents, who are literally going to die, to die. Councilmember Crystal Murillo said she agreed with Combs' objections, but would support the items in the interests of giving agencies something rather than nothing. The council is scheduled to vote on the recommendations November 27th. APS leans toward turning Paris School into a community center, but lease price is an issue. Correction. A previous version of this story stated that former Superintendent Rico Munn recommended selling the Paris Elementary School building, but it was Interim Superintendent Mark Seglem who made the recommendation. Also, the Sentinel incorrectly reported that Paris, South, Sable, and 6th Avenue Elementary Schools are slated to close at the end of this school year. They have already closed. Aurora. A discussion and plan to repurpose an elementary school targeted for closure drew confusion Tuesday from the Aurora Public Schools board members. During the board meeting, Superintendent Michael Giles said he wanted to lease Paris Elementary School, which closed earlier this school year, to nonprofit groups YAASPA and the ABC Collective to create a kind of community center. YAASPA is a Colorado-based group that offers culturally responsive programs for youth. ABC Collective is a group of local organizations such as Aurora Wellness and Apprentice for Peace that are partnering together specifically to repurpose Paris Elementary. The YAASPA plan was among four proposals made by various groups and businesses to redevelop Paris after it closes. As we went through the process, the response we got from that particular zone had the ABC Collective with the highest priority rating and lowest disapproval rating, and that means something, Giles said. Former APS Interim Superintendent Mark Seglem initially wanted to sell the school, but Giles decided that it would be better for the district to keep the building as an asset and lease it instead. However, Giles explained that funding remains the biggest issue. According to the presentation, the current market value to lease a building that size is $1.2 million a year, or $100,000 per month. It includes maintenance and operating costs. The organization's proposed budget indicated a yearly rent of $48,000 for the entire school. District officials later said the lease payments would be targets in a negotiation. A vote was not needed for this agenda item, but was categorized as an action item because the board could have gone in any direction during this discussion. Anything that could cause the board to vote is procedurally required to be categorized as an action item, according to Brandon Iyer, the district's legal director. A motion was made and seconded by directors Tremaine Duncan and Stephanie Mason to follow Giles' recommendation to negotiate with the community organizations. But then directors Ann Kiki and Nichelle Ortiz said they had additional questions. Iyer explained to the board that because a motion has been made and seconded, they can continue discussions as a group, but outside information is usually cut off. He recommended that the board rescind the motion because it sounds like there is still information gathering that is still requested. Duncan rescinded his motion. After some thought, Mason did not rescind her motion. Nearly 16 minutes later, after the board had discussed other topics and were seemingly prepared to move in onto the next presentation scheduled for the night, Duncan said, "Just for clarification purposes, this is an action item, but I thought on action items we vote." Iyer further explained it was categorized as an action item and not an information item because there was the possibility of a vote. Other questions centered around vendors. Director Michael Carter asked if the other vendors were also given the option to lease the building and if they submitted lease agreements. Marianne Sammons, the district's strategic development advisor, explained that all vendors were informed that Giles wanted to lease the building. She added that the community organizations, as well as two other vendors, were willing to lease the building. Sammons also explained that none of the vendors submitted proposed lease agreements, and the information that was presented to Giles was the same information that was presented to the former superintendent last school year. Approximately 15 minutes after Sammons answered Carter's questions and after the board had discussed other topics, Director Vicki Reinhard circled back and asked for clarification on Giles' plan to lease the building to the community organizations and asked if the information he had received was the same information the previous superintendent received. Ortiz explained that the awkwardness was because Giles was giving the board a lot of courtesy and heads up. "It's kind of like we're getting input at this stage," she said. "That's why this seems so different for me." Kiki echoed Ortiz's sentiments. "If we're going to move forward and make this successful, then I think the board needs to be informed and behind it on the very front end. So that was the whole purpose of coming in here and having this conversation," Giles said. The board ultimately supported Giles' recommendation to negotiate with the community organizations. Blueprint APS. Paris Elementary School closed at the end of last school year, and is one of the 8 schools that were slated to be closed or be repurposed due to declining student enrollment. The other schools are Century Elementary School, Lynn Knoll Elementary School, Peoria Elementary School, Wheeling Elementary School, Sable Elementary School, closed, 6th Avenue Elementary School, closed, South Middle School, closed. 4 of the schools have already been repurposed for educational purposes. Wheeling Elementary School was repurposed into the Clara Brown Entrepreneurial Academy. Peoria Elementary School was repurposed into the new location for remote learning opportunities. The Lynn Knoll Elementary School facilities was knocked down and a new P8 Academy was built on the site. Century Elementary School will serve as a new location for Sierra School, which will serve students with significant behavioral needs. The school district began accepting proposals to repurpose Paris and Sable Elementary Schools last December. The latter will be repurposed into an early education development center that will open next school year. In May, the board chose to postpone decisions for Paris Elementary School's future and wait until a new superintendent was hired. The previous superintendent, Rico Mune, resigned at the end of last school year. Giles began as a superintendent this past summer. The recording of the nearly 2.5-hour long meeting is available for the public to view on YouTube or on the district website. Shot in the dark. Schools in Colorado, the nation, seeing falling vaccine rates. By Mike Stobie, AP Medical Right, and Christine O., Sentinel, Colorado. Aurora. The proportion of U.S. kindergartners exempted from school vaccination requirements has hit its highest level ever, 3%, according to U.S. health officials. Colorado school vaccination rates, notoriously low among states, have also been trending down. The bad news is that it's gone down since the pandemic and still hasn't rebounded, said Dr. Sean O'Leary, a University of Colorado pediatric infectious diseases specialist. The good news is that the vast majority of parents are still vaccinating their kids according to the recommended schedule. More parents are questioning routine childhood vaccinations that they used to automatically accept, an effect of the political schism that emerged during the pandemic around COVID-19 vaccines, experts say. Aurora schools are echoing national trends in vaccinations and are seeing fewer students fully vaccinated this school year. State records show that 85% of all Aurora Public School District students are fully immunized this school year, according to the data from the state. The district's vaccination compliance rate has been decreasing since the 2019-20 school year. And 82% of district kindergartners are fully vaccinated, the lowest vaccination rate in the last 6 years. An average of 1% of APS kindergartners received exemptions for all vaccinations this school year. Also, 89% of all Cherry Creek students are fully immunized this school year. The district's vaccination compliance rate has been decreasing slightly every year since the 2019-20 school year. However, 87% of district kindergartners are fully vaccinated this school year. An average of 2% of Cherry Creek kindergartners received exemptions for all vaccinations this school year. Cherry Creek has registered nurses at every school who provides resources to families. They are unable to administer vaccinations, but refer families to health care providers such as Stride Clinics, Shots for Tots, and teens and the student's own provider, according to district spokesperson Lauren Snell. In APS, their health staff refer families to community immunization events and to the district's 4 school-based health clinics. APS spokesperson Corey Christensen also said that the district's Medicaid department also helps families connect with community resources and apply for federal funding. There is also limited funding available to support uninsured students with health services. Herd immunity, which is when a large portion of the community is immune to a disease making it difficult for it to spread, varies for each disease, according to a report from the Mayo Clinic. For measles, a highly contagious viral respiratory disease, approximately 94% of the population must be immune in order to prevent it from spreading. In APS, 85% of kindergartner students are vaccinated against measles this school year. In Cherry Creek, 91% are vaccinated against it. Only 3 school districts in the state saw a 100% immunization rate against measles: Campo School District, located near the Colorado-Oklahoma border; Creed School District, located in southwest Colorado; and Edison School District, located southeast of Colorado Springs. Moffitt 2 School District in southern Colorado had the lowest immunization rate against measles this school year. Only 59.6% of their students were fully immunized. According to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, children entering child care are required to have the following vaccinations: hepatitis B, Hep B, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, DTaP, hemophilus, influenza type B, HIB, inactivated polovirus, IPV, pneumococcal conjugate, PCV, measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, varicella, chickenpox. Children in K-19 are required to have the following vaccinations: hepatitis B, hep B, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, DTaP, inactivated polio virus, IPM, measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, varicella, chickenpox, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, TDAP. According to state spokesperson Anne Marie Harper, students with an exemption from one or more school-required vaccines may be kept out of school or child care during a disease outbreak to prevent unvaccinated children. The state defines non-medical exemptions as a parent or guardian having a personal belief or following a religious teaching that is opposed to immunizations. There are two ways to receive a non-medical exemption. A parent must submit a certificate with a signature from a Colorado doctor or osteopathic medicine, advanced practice nurse, physician assistant, associate, registered nurse, or pharmacist. Or a parent must complete an education module provided on the state website at cdphe.colorado.gov. An exemption will be granted after participation without having to provide a supporting explanation. Even though more kids were given exemptions, the national vaccination rate held steady. 93% of kindergartners got their required shots for the 2022-2023 school year, the same as the year before, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said in a report Thursday. The rate was 95% in the years before the COVID-19 pandemic. All U.S. states and territories require that children attending child care centers and schools be vaccinated against a number of diseases, including measles, mumps, polio, tetanus, whooping cough, and chickenpox. All states allow exemptions for children with medical conditions that prevents them from receiving certain vaccinations, and most also permit exceptions for religious or other non-medical reasons. In the last decade, the percentage of kindergartners with medical exemptions has held steady at about 0.2%, but the percentage with non-medical exemptions has inched up, lifting the overall exemption rate from 1.6% in the 2011 to 2012 school year to 3% last year. Last year, more than 115,000 kindergartens were exempt from at least one vaccine, the CDC estimated. The rates vary across the country. 10 states, all in the Midwest or Midwest, reported that more than 5% of kindergartners were exempted from at least one kind of required vaccination. Idaho had the highest percentage, with 12% of kindergartners receiving at least one exemption. In contrast, 0.1% had exemptions in New York. The rates can be influenced by state laws or policies can make it harder or easier to obtain exemptions, and by local attitudes among families and doctors about the need to get children vaccinated. Sometimes these jumps in exemptions can be very local, and it may not reflect a whole state, said O'Leary, who chairs an American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. Hawaii saw the largest jump, with the exemption rate rising to 6.4%, nearly double the year before. Officials there said it's not due to any law or policy change. Rather, we have observed that there has been misinformation, disinformation impacting people's decisions to vaccinate or not via social media platforms, officials at the state's health department said in a statement. Connecticut and Maine saw significant declines, which CDC officials attributed to recent policy changes that made it harder to get exemptions. Health officials say attaining 95% vaccination coverage is important to prevent outbreaks of preventable diseases, especially of measles, which is extremely contagious. The U.S. has seen measles outbreaks begin when travelers infected elsewhere come to communities with low vaccination rates. That happened in 2019 when about 1,300 measles cases were reported, the most in the U.S. in nearly 30 years. Most of the cases were in Orthodox Jewish communities with low vaccination rates. One apparent paradox in the report: the national vaccination rate held steady even as exemptions increased. How could that be? CDC officials say it's because there are actually three groups of children in the vaccination statistics. One is those who get all the shots, a second is those who get exemptions. The third are children who didn't seek exemptions but also didn't get all their shots and paperwork completed at the time the data was collected. Last year, those kids in the third group probably decreased, offsetting the increase in the exemption group, the CDC's Shannon Stokely said. Suspect identified in murder of Centennial Man. The Lone Tree Police Department has identified a suspect in the homicide of a 73-year-old Centennial Man that happened November 4th in Lone Tree, and authorities are asking the public for help locating the suspect. The suspect is 23-year-old James Matthew Neal, who was last seen in the Colorado Springs area and is considered armed and dangerous, the police department said in a November 15th news release. According to images shared by Metro Denver Crime Stoppers, Neal appears to be a white male with a large neck tattoo and several smaller face tattoos. There is an active warrant for Neal's arrest for homicide, according to the Metro Denver Crime Stoppers. If someone sees Neal, they should call 911 first, the organization said. Anyone with information that could help law enforcement locate Neal should contact Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867 or the Lone Tree Police Department's tip line at 720-509-1160. According to Metro Denver Crime Stoppers, people with information can remain anonymous and potentially earn up to $2,000. At approximately 12:25 p.m. November 4th, law enforcement reportedly found Michael Lomier, a 73-year-old Centennial resident, deceased in a car parked in the 8500 block of South Yosemite Street in Lone Tree. It appeared he died of an apparent gunshot wound, the police department said. LPS swears in new members, says goodbye to Reichardt. The Littleton Public Schools Board of Education officially swore in its recently elected members and said farewell to one who has served the district for many years. Lindley McCrary and Sharia Garcia Cooper took their oaths of office on November 16th after the district certified the unofficial election results that declared them victorious. McCrary is beginning her second term on the board, while Garcia Cooper is taking her seat for the first time. Garcia Cooper is replacing Robert Reichardt, who has reached his term limit. I would like to express my sincere gratitude to the Littleton Public Schools community for electing me to serve on this board for a second term, McCrary said. It is an honor to serve this community in this capacity, and I am incredibly excited for the work ahead. She thanked Garcia Cooper, Michelle Redfern, and Brian McCauley for showing their dedication to the district by running for office. She also thanked her family for their support throughout the process. Garcia Cooper said she worked hard throughout the campaign process, and it is amazing to officially be on the board. I feel excited and humbled that I was elected to serve the students and staff of Littleton Public Schools, she said, and I cannot wait to get to work. The board expressed their gratitude to Reichardt, who has served on the board since 2015. Robert, you have devoted 8 years of selfless service to this community, and with every decision you have made, you have done so in the best interest of students, said President Angela Christensen. You have taught me to be a better board member and a better leader, and I am so grateful for your support of me, of this board, and of this district. Since he has reached the end of his time on the school board, Reichardt will continue his leadership in the community by serving District 3 on the Littleton City Council. I hope it's been clear that I'm really grateful for the time and the opportunity that I've had to serve on this board and for the collegiality I've had amongst my board members and amongst the staff, he said. This has been a wonderful experience. Reichardt reflected on some of the board's accomplishments over the past 8 years, including changing start times, passing a bond and a mill levy override, changing boundaries, closing schools, navigating the pandemic, and hiring a new superintendent. I feel like I'm leaving the district in good hands, he said, highlighting the district's educators, staff administrators, and board members. I'm so grateful to everyone who ran for the board, and I'm so grateful that our community chose Cherie as my replacement. After the new board was seated, the members elected their officers. Christensen will continue to serve as the board's president, with Andrew Graham as her vice president. McCrary will remain treasurer, and Joan Anderson as the new board secretary. Garcia Cooper is the board's new assistant secretary. Arapahoe County will certify the election results on November 27th. SpaceX rocket booster arrives at new home in Littleton, by Nina Joss. A 154-foot SpaceX rocket booster has arrived at its new home outside of the Dish Network corporate offices in Littleton, on the southwest quadrant of the intersection of Bowles Avenue and Santa Fe Drive. It is a Falcon 9, which is a type of reusable rocket that SpaceX uses for repeated launches. According to SpaceX's website, the Falcon 9 is the first orbital-class reusable rocket in the world. This particular booster is being repurposed as an exhibit, sitting atop three pedestals on the Dish Network campus. It sits about 12 feet in the air, crossing over Littleton's Creek Trail, Littleton Public Works Director Keith Reister said. Dish Network, a satellite television company headquartered in unincorporated Douglas County, approached the city of Littleton in 2021 to pitch the project, according to the city. Reister said SpaceX donated the booster to Dish, and the maintenance and security of the exhibit are Dish's responsibilities. The city helped with the regulatory side of the project, but has no direct cost because the Telluray Foundation, a local foundation, provided a $2.4 million grant to cover the costs of project development and installation. The Telluray Foundation declined to comment for this story. Reister said he expects the contractors to finish the construction of the exhibit site, including fencing, ground leveling, a walkway, and signage in early December. I think that there's a lot of people that are interested in this kind of thing, and we hope to see them here, Reister said. From an economic standpoint, more tourism will give a boost to our community, and those are all really good things. It'll be an ongoing draw, I think. The exhibit site will be accessible from the Mary Carter Greenway Trail and Littleton's Creek Trail, and there will be no public parking on site, Reister said. There will be wayfinding signs to guide visitors from downtown Littleton and the Littleton Downtown RTD station, which are about a half a mile away. Why Littleton? The display will be one of only three of its kind in the country. One Falcon 9 rocket booster sits outside of the SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne, California, while another is at Space City Space Center Houston in Texas. Reister said part of the reason the exhibit makes sense in Littleton is because of the city's connection with the aerospace industry. We have a long aerospace history, and DISH happens to be one of the leaders in aerospace in Littleton now, he said. Aerospace company Lockheed Martin has had a large presence in the Littleton area for decades. United Launch Alliance, a space launch company that competes with SpaceX, is headquartered in Centennial. At a July City Council meeting, Canty Ergen, co-founder of DISH Network, said the booster should be on display in Littleton because of the city's connection to the aerospace industry. We all talk about STEM education, Ergen said. We all want to excite kids and families and learners to understand technology that our country leads in right now. And we think that for DISH to have the opportunity to do this in partnership with the City of Littleton and the Foundation is something that would be beneficial to the City of Littleton. But the company's relationship to SpaceX is a little bit more complicated, with a history of legal disputes between the companies. In January, DISH sued SpaceX to try to stop its satellite internet service, Starlink, from launching its next-generation satellite network. In May, SpaceX won a spectrum dispute with DISH regarding access to the 12 gigahertz spectrum. But according to Ergen, the companies also work together. At the July meeting, she said DISH has launched satellites on SpaceX boosters six times. DISH Network did not respond to recent requests for comments for this story. DISH's recent finances. In early November, DISH announced that it will be laying off about 500 Colorado employees in the coming months. It also reported its third quarter 2023 finances, which showed revenue totaling $3.70 billion, down from $4.10 billion for the corresponding period in 2022. It reported losing $139 million in the quarter, and Forbes reported its shares fell to a 25-year low. When asked what would happen to the booster if DISH is financially no longer able to maintain it, Reister said the agreement between the city and DISH holds the company responsible. This is like a lot of public installations, whether it be art or otherwise, Reister said. We felt from the beginning that it was critical for DISH to have maintenance in perpetuity. So our attorneys made sure that that was reflected in the agreement so that the city didn't end up with an unexpected future cost that we weren't planning for. Reister said DISH was on board with this agreement from the beginning. He said that in the case of an acquisition, any potential successor companies would be responsible for the booster. DISH Network has not responded to recent requests for comment for this story. Online posts show community members have expressed mixed reviews about the booster so far. Some are excited about the opportunity to see the object up close, while others have deemed it ugly and out of place near the natural trails. There has been a detour in place on Littleton's Creek Trail and the Mary Carter Greenway near the exhibit for over 2 months, Reister said, and the trails will reopen when construction is complete. School volunteers face higher bar than board members for backgrounds, by Elizabeth Slay. Amid the controversy over New Inglewood school board member-elect Devon Williams and his criminal background, residents have questioned whether or not he would be permitted to volunteer at the district he's representing based on its background check requirements. Williams, who is scheduled to be sworn in to the Inglewood School Board at 6 p.m. on December 5th, has a court appearance set for 8:30 a.m. on December 6th for a felony car theft accusation stemming from an incident in 2019. The Colorado Judicial Branch online docket shows Williams' appearance on bond is set for a one-hour appearance on bond hearing in Adams County Court District 6 in Brighton. According to Superintendent Joanna Polzin, the background requirements for the district are based on Board Policy KI and IJOC. Polzin said there are different requirements for school board members to interact with students and for people to volunteer at school events such as field trips. Visiting a school and volunteering are viewed as two different purposes in Inglewood schools, according to our board policies, Polzin said. District 3 State Rep. Meg Froelich, Democrat, Arapahoe County, did not have a lot to say about this issue, but told the Inglewood Herald in an November 13th email that she is upset about this situation, but has only begun to look into state law or possible solutions. I need to meet with my local Inglewood activist and community members, Froelich said. Board policy IJOC states that because Colorado law requires school districts to conduct background checks for potential employees applying for positions, the Inglewood School Board determined that the need exists for similar background checks of volunteers who work with a school district students. School background check may include, but not be limited to, making an inquiry to the Colorado Department of Education, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and or other law enforcement agency to determine if there is any information on record indicating that the individual has been convicted of a crime involving unlawful sexual behavior or unlawful behavior with children, the policy states. Additionally, it says people who fail to provide the proper information to complete a background check will not be able to volunteer with the district. The decision made by the school district concerning an individual's fitness is to volunteer in the school setting shall be final, the policy states. Dwayne Tucker, president of the Inglewood Schools Board of Education, said the qualifications for school board candidates are established by Colorado Revised Statute Section 22-31-107. Candidates are required to file an affidavit of school director candidate on qualifications for office with the Designated Election Office, DEO, Tucker said. The DEO is allowed to rely on the affidavit and the candidate's certifications therein without further investigation. According to the Inglewood School Board candidate site, those qualifications include be a registered voter in the school district for at least 12 consecutive months before the election, not have been convicted of committing a sexual offense against a child, and because school director elections are nonpartisan, candidates may not campaign as members of a political party. Polzin said Board Policy KI, which references the procedure for visits from school board members, recently underwent some language changes, which the board approved on November 8th. Polzin said the board will have a second reading under consensus items on December 5th. The language changes added that all requests for visits by board members must be coordinated through the superintendent. Board members have always been expected to coordinate school visits through the superintendent. This was the practice of the previous superintendent as well, Polzin said. This is the recommended practice by Colorado Association of School Boards, CASB, in their leadership workbook for board members. Polson said during the school day she is with board members when they visit any campus. Before they enter a school building, Polson said school board members are expected to ring the doorbell and be buzzed into the office like any visitor. They have to present their driver's license, then the license is run through a system we use called Raptor, and they must wear the sticker name badge that Raptor produces while in our school, Polson said. This is the same practice for any visitor, parent, or guardian who comes into the school. We also ask the board members to wear their gold name tag that indicates they are a board member. Williams and fellow director-elect Katie Wildenberg-Cross are scheduled to have their photos taken and be sworn in at the board's next meeting on December 5th. Littleton City Council swears in elected members. Tears were shed at the Littleton City Council meeting on November 21st as Jerry Valdez said farewell to the dais where he has served for more than a decade. He and Kelly Milliman, who finished her term as the District 4 representative, wrapped up their time on the council to welcome two newly elected members to the dais. New District 2 council member Robert Reichardt and District 4 council member Andrea Volkovich Peters took their oaths, officially kicking off their terms on the city council. Pam Grove, who was re-elected to serve an in at-large seat, was sworn into her second term. Congratulations to council member Pam Grove on your re-election, Valdez said. Also to the new council members, congratulations. Have fun. Enjoy this. It's a great time. It really is. Be civil to each other on your council and be prepared for every meeting. Goodbye to Valdez and Milliman. Valdez served the city for a total of 26 years. Before sitting on the council, where he served 2 years as mayor, he sat on the Planning Commission, Board of Adjustment, and the South Metro Housing Options Board. During his tenure on council, Valdez voted approximately 1,763 times, he said. He served alongside 20 different council members on seven different councils. He thanked his colleagues, friends, family, and the Littleton community for their support during his decades of service. Thank you to my incredible wife for encouraging me and supporting me to be involved in our city, he said. Thank you, City of Littleton. City Manager Jim Blecklenburg recognized Valdez for always being well prepared, asking important questions, and having fun. I, along with the rest of our staff, will remember Councilmember Valdez as a consummate Littleton cheerleader and advocate who really guarded our history and our values and prioritized keeping Littleton safe, clean, and attractive for all of us, he said. In reflecting on Milliman's service to the council, Blecklenburg highlighted her all-in attitude and her passion about making progress happen. Specifically, he recognized her fearless commitment to housing initiatives and her support of the arts community. Kelly, your staff will remember you for your strong support and empathy from the dais, for fearlessly advocating for the most important issues for the last few years, Blecklenburg said. Most of all, I will remember your superpower as a listener to citizens who need help. Milliman thanked Peters and Reichardt for running for office and gave them advice for their time on the council. I would like to say thank you to you two for being conscientious and wanting to run for council and advocate for our community, she said. Be open-minded, thoughtful, kind, and work well with these council members and also with the staff. Once the new council members were seated, they chose their new mayor pro tem. The person in this role, chosen after each general election, acts as mayor during absences of the mayor. The city council chose District 3 council member Stephen Barr as their next mayor pro tem, replacing at-large council member Gretchen Ryden in the role. Thank you to the council for vesting this trust in me, Barr said. Bomb threat suspect indicted after joint investigation between Parker Police, FBI. A federal grand jury has indicted a suspect for making false bomb claims in public buildings in Parker earlier this year. Through a coordinated effort between the Parker Police Department and the FBI, Matthew Cook was indicted on two counts of 18 U.S.C. 1038A1 for falsely conveying a bomb threat. Earlier this year, there were five bomb threats made to various buildings throughout the town of Parker between June and September, according to Josh Hans, spokesperson for the Parker Police Department. On June 1st, Parker Police responded to a bomb threat at a Safeway. Another threat was made on July 26 at the Cottonwood King Supers, followed by a threat on August 17th at the Parker Walmart. There were two more threats in September, one at the Douglas County Library Parker branch on September 14th, and another at the Costco on September 18th. According to the press release announcing the indictment, allegedly Cook falsely claimed that there was a bomb at the Cottonwood King Supers and the Parker Walmart. In a press release, the Parker Police Department thanked the community for their patience as authorities investigated the false bomb threats with the FBI's assistance. At this time, it is unknown what led authorities to Cook. Art Students League of Denver introduces new winter holiday art market by Natalie Kerr. Giuliana Marcesia, a mixed media artist who teaches digital photography at the Art Students League of Denver, believes the work of local artists make great gifts because they are often one of a kind and have a unique personality from the artist. As we navigate this world where small businesses are slowly falling and big corporations are taking over, I feel that as human beings in these wonderful communities, we should support these art makers more than ever, Marcesia said. The community will have the opportunity to do just that with the ASLD's inaugural Winter Holiday Art Market, WAM, on December 6th and 10th. WAM is a seasonal event modeled off of ASLD Summer Art Market, SAM. ASLD has been hosting SAM for 30 years and got the idea for WAM from faculty who wanted more opportunities to showcase their work and promote the organization, said Tessa Chrisman, Director of Communications and Development at ASLD. For people who love to go to SAM and have artists they always stop to check out, this will be a great way to meet some new people in our community, Chrisman said. WAM will feature art from 30 artists, all of whom work and teach at ASLD. Because WAM will feature a smaller group of artists than SAM, it will allow people to explore their work more in depth, Chrisman said. It's very fun to be in a room with these people who are part of the same arts community and show up for each other and together, Chrisman said. That energy really comes across when you attend one of these events. The December 9th market will take place in the evening and will have a live DJ and food and drink from Trev Brewing and Music Sea Hot Chicken. December 10th is geared toward families and takes place during the daytime. All ticket proceeds from both days will go to support ASLD's programs and classes, and all artists will keep the proceeds from the purchases of their work. Connor Chow, a painting and drawing teacher at ASLD, is excited to see his colleagues' work after his first session teaching. Chow enjoys selling his work at markets because it lets him connect with people interested in purchasing his paintings. I really like that you can interact with people who are looking at your work, Chow said. If someone decides they want to buy a painting, you can be there to talk to them about the process and what inspired you to make the painting. Chow paints many iconic Colorado scenes that people will likely recognize. and will have prints and original pieces available that make great gifts for locals, he said. Marcrecio plans to sell a variety of her handmade bags, which include vinyl bags with her photograph screens printed onto the material, and hand-sewn bags made from faux fur that are designed to look like spiders. Like Chow, one of Marcrecio's favorite parts about art markets like WAM is getting to have conversations with people who attend and hear how they interpret her work. Often people who are coming to art markets are positive, kind people who make the event really enjoyable, she said. It's a wonderful thing to support these nonprofit organizations and artists who really love art and sharing it with other people, Marcrecio said. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.